We are reading and celebrating and exploring different aspects of Jamie Ford's love and other consolation prizes. So we have tonight this wonderful panel of three lovely women here who have a really rich expertise when it comes to this topic. And so I'm going to just go ahead and introduce them first, and then we'll go again. And get started. Okay. So I'm going to begin by saying my name is Heidi Robison, and I teach at the high school. I'm an English teacher at Bozeman High School. So our first panelist tonight is Dr. Jennifer Hill from MSU, and she's in the American Studies faculty. And her research really focuses on the history of reproduction, as in, obviously, childbirth, contraception, abortion, and venereal disease, especially with regard to the effects by state and local health departments to control and treat various sexually transmitted diseases. Our second is Crystal Alegria, and she is the co-director and co-founder of the Extreme History Project, and the goal is to really bring history alive and make it fun and engaging and get people in the community involved in history, and I think that's really important. Her focus is community history and uncovering stories from the past that have maybe been ignored or neglected or even actively sort of suppressed. In putting together the sort of tours of Bozeman, she has become interested in and has done research on our red light district here in Bozeman and the history of that, and the lives of Bozeman's early sex workers and many of the women who considered that district their home during that time period. She has a love of medical history and wrote her master's thesis on the medical history of soldiers at Fort Ellis. So very rich local history. And then finally, we have Cindy Spinelli, and she is working at the Community Health Department. She is the Communicable Disease Program Manager at Gallatin County Health Department. Her team runs the immunization clinic and follows up on 40-plus communicable diseases and conditions that must be reported to the health department. But in addition to that, or as part of that, that includes syphilis. And she's also on the board of the AIDS Outreach, which in Bozeman, a based community organization that provides rapid HIV and syphilis testing. So we have a wealth of knowledge here, and so I think we'll just go ahead and begin. I'm going to have questions that are just for you largely as general questions that you all feel free to answer. And then I have questions that are specific to your field of expertise and sort of your, I guess, your special interest in the topic. So my first question is, just as a reader, what were your impressions of Love and Other Consolation Prizes?
I would say that, you know, given the fact that I deal with reproduction historically, for the most part, I am always excited with anything that normalizes or even touches on these topics that are so much a part of people's everyday lives, both historically and in contemporary society, but that just don't get talked about. So, like, the first couple pages in, I was like, oh, yes, this is so awesome that this is even getting talked about. So I think that, we can talk about all sorts of things with the book specifically, but one of my great appreciations of it was raising a topic, humanizing it, giving it a sense for, like, these were real people who dealt with this, and helping us sort of engage our minds and our personal experience with the fact that this was sort of an everyday thing for some people was sort of my initial reaction to reading the book.
I agree that I love historical fiction. I think it's a great way to interact with history, and this was a great book that did that very well. And I think that as I was reading this book and listening to it too, I listened to a lot of books. I was thinking about and really thinking about our red light district and thinking about the Bozeman history that would connect the similarities and the differences that we have here in Bozeman. And so there are so many similarities between this story and stories that probably happened right here where we're sitting. So I think that's one thing that I was thinking about when I was reading this book, but that's, of course, what I think about when I read any historical fiction novel. I really try to think about that history and think about how these authors do so much to really bring in a lot of historical research. They do a lot of historical research themselves. So bringing in that history is so important. And I think that Jamie Ford did such a great job of that and did really personalize this very important history.
I feel like I might have been the target audience for this book. I love historical fiction. I love a strong female lead, and there were several in this book. I flew through it. I actually had to go back and read it more carefully to pull out some of the things because it was so intriguing to figure out what happened.
So to follow up on that question, I guess my next one, which is natural, how well do you think this particular novel referenced the topic of syphilis? You know, how well do you think it was incorporated? Given your combined, knowledge of this topic is pretty rich. And so how well do you think it was sort of depicted? Did you feel like it was realistic given the time period? We have two time periods, right? We have the early 20th century and then we have the 1960s. And so did you feel like there was, that the novel accurately represented sort of shifting attitudes during that time period? I'm sort of curious about that.
I thought it was interesting because these two women were so protected from kind of the outside world. You know, Madame Flora had her group of people that even though there were protesters coming through, it seemed like they just laughed at them, really. And then the family protected Gracie, too. And it is important there were lots of other women who didn't have the same experience, and really anyone who was other. If you were poor, if you were a person of color, if you were a woman, treatment was a lot harder for you to get. So that was just one of the things. The other thing I was thinking about was they focused on neurosyphilis, and there's a couple, that's not the only endpoint of untreated syphilis. It's probably the most interesting one, though.
I think that Jamie really did a good job of expressing how syphilis wasn't spoken about, or any of these diseases weren't spoken about during that 1909 time period, 1910 time period, but also in the 1960 time period. And I see that a lot with our, right here in our red light district, it was very much not spoken of. And a lot of women who worked in this field, who were madams, who were women who were prostitutes, they didn't talk about it either, and they didn't want anyone else to be talking about it. So for me, he really did a good job of showing that. And there was a woman, a lot of madams in later years wrote biographies, or they wrote memoirs about their time as madams. And one madam in particular, her name was Josie Washburn, and she wrote a whole little pamphlet on how no one spoke about syphilis and how that was such a problem during her time when she was working in the business. But even in that current time, she wrote that in 1913. And so she had been working in the business for many, many years, but she thought that was the biggest crime, is that people weren't speaking about this even in 1913. And so she was trying to do everything she could to get laws passed so that people would just start talking about these diseases and syphilis in particular. She was speaking expressly to syphilis. So
you both have sort of touched on the things that I noticed. First of all, the fact that when we think about that there was so much cultural shift between these two time periods, but also that some things didn't shift. And I would say that some things still haven't shifted, in the sense that there's still so much shame associated with some of these topics. And that's one of my real sort of reasons for being so vested in the topic, that I would put it in the larger framework of reproduction as a whole, that this is important human stuff. And it was important to talk about back then, and it's important to talk about now, because it has so much to do with who we are as people and how we relate to each other. So we can certainly see some changes in those time periods, but I also think we can see some similarities. And unfortunately, still some similarities today. So it's interesting to me, you know, reading this, I would love to come across some sort of oral history recording, some more primary source documentation in terms of how people really felt who, you know, as they were working, you know, either themselves or with people they knew. The problem is, at least as a historian, those things are so few and far between. So we have to rely on sort of historical fiction to extrapolate what those experiences were like, because people just didn't record that stuff. One of my favorite oral historians or oral histories that I refer to often in my research, a woman was being asked in the 1980s, all right, so this is not that long ago, about what form of contraception she used. And she was referring back to what she had used as a young person. So she was referring back to like the 1920s. And her comment was, "We had it all figured out, but I'm not going to discuss our methods." And I think that that's sort of, we can apply that to so many things. Like, no, I didn't deal with it, or we had it figured out, but don't ask me about details. And I think that's sort of something that we still do when it comes to these topics, much, I think, to our detriment. So I thought this book did a really fabulous job of helping us sort of get our minds wrapped around sort of the unchangeable nature of some of the shame that is still associated with it.
I thought this was kind of interesting, too, when you look back on the history of diseases. I'm so interested to hear about what you have to say with the history of reportable diseases. But with syphilis in particular, if you were a wealthy woman or wealthy man and went to the doctor, they would keep your name from being reported. So it would be like Dr. So-and-so's patient was treated for syphilis. But if you went to the county or the free clinics, then your name got reported. So again, like another difference that you see there.
And so there's this whole idea of stigma, right? Which is still, I think, quite alive and well, you know, that's something you can speak to, which would be sort of interesting, you know, what our more common public attitudes are. But so given that, I think why do you feel that infectious diseases, and in this case, and in this novel, that, you know, syphilis, why do you think they're so why do you think they fascinate the world of fiction? Why do you think that that is something that, you know, because that's something readers really note in this particular novel, but it's also sort of titillating. You know, why is that? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I was talking with my coworker. It's a really good character to add to a book like this infectious disease. And it's usually, there's sex. People love to talk about sex. it's just a good way to tell a story. And then you have all of the artists and writers who were, or people think had syphilis. So that's a whole nother aspect to it.
Completely agree. You know, sex is interesting. And so this is just an aspect of that. And these, I love how you say that syphilis was another character, because it really is another character as part of this book. And so I guess I just agree with what you said, Cindy. But I think it's interesting to bring that in. And probably there's so much, you know, this is something that is so not talked about that we're interested in talking about it, or we're interested in hearing about it, I guess, mm-hmm. is what's happening. One more thing.
You can have
You know, I just want to say we do a whole series of walking tours, and of course our most popular walking tour is murders, madams, and mediums, you know, sex and murder and all those things that we don't hopefully experience in our regular everyday life. So that speaks to it a little bit in addition.
Okay, now you can have I'll take it. I think that the idea of infectious disease is so fascinating, though, because it has a life of its own, literally. And I think that that is really interesting as we think about other human beings, because as a scholar of culture, I'm always looking at how we relate to each other. And the idea that we can relate to each other in a way that has a lasting impact on someone else, in this case, sort of a negative lasting impact. But we're always thinking, like, you know, how did my contact with that person, did it mean anything to them? How are we related as a community? And infectious disease is a very tangible way of sort of tracking that we have real and lasting impact on each other. And I to a certain extent, that validates our human connection. Even though infectious disease is sort of a negative way of portraying that, it's also a very measurable way of the fact that even though we think of ourselves as being so independent, we are so very, very tied to each other in very real and meaningful ways.
And actually, now that you have the mic, I have a question that's for you, and it's really based on your research. So your research has primarily been on the history of childbirth, and so that involves many stages, as we know. And as you read this novel, did you find yourself sort of filtering a lot of what you read or thinking about what you read and sort of applying your historian's, you know, your historian's perspective and then also your background and your research and thinking about the novel in that context? And are there any connections to your research and this storyline at all?
Well, I think there's certainly connections in the sense that we tend to historically, I won't digress into a history lecture. My children would be very proud of me, but I'll make a little short one. 1875, Anthony Comstock passed a law that made the sale or manufacture of any contraceptive devices illegal. And it really drew this very clear line between good women and bad women. And this sense that there is good sex and bad sex and good reproduction and bad reproduction, and that people had to be so careful, not just about what they did, but about what they were perceived to do. Thus the oral history comment where she didn't want to share what contraceptive methods she had used because she didn't want to be perceived as a bad woman. So seeing sort of very much reading this novel from the perspective of, like the fact that there's only these two categories and you have to be in one of them or the other one depending on sort of where you fall in that line. And I would argue that that line is still very much present. I don't think it has disappeared. So absolutely, I definitely read this with reference to sort of that whole framework in terms of how we categorize each other based on behavior.
And then I think that falls in naturally to the question that I had about you, for you, Cindy, that you and I were talking about even before, we kind of talked about this in preparation, but also earlier tonight. And that is just, this novel spans a long period of time, as you know, if you have read it, and you talked about how much had changed. So it's that question of sort of, you know, what is, I mean, where is my question? What do I have here? I want to make sure that I get it the way I want to make sure I phrase it correctly. But it says the portrayal of syphilis in the book compared to how syphilis was treated and experienced historically. And I know you said that there's so many events that happened between the early 20th century and the 1960s.
We were talking about this because I don't know if the author did it on purpose, but from 1909, when the book first starts, to 1962, there were so many events. So we have the first test to identify syphilis in like 1906, right when the book opens. We get the first antibiotic that really is going to treat syphilis, like 1911. It's called Salvarsan. It's actually an arsenic derivative. And sometimes the treatment was worse than the disease in this case. And then we have World War I and the Depression. And with the Depression, we get the WPA. And there was some money given to artists to actually create art related to what they called venereal disease at the time. And so there's a play in Seattle called The Spirochete, which is the type of bacteria syphilis is. And it was a play, and it was actually to convince the doctors to support a bill that would include syphilis testing for pregnant women to prevent congenital syphilis, and then also as premarital, so you can maybe find out what type of wife you were going to get. So we have that going on in the 30s. And then we have World War II. And originally, men with VD were not able to go to war, and we get penicillin right after that. And they're like, we need to get these men treated and sent out to the front. So there's a big push for treatment with penicillin, and it's so effective. After the war, then we have more penicillin, and we can start treating lots of people, and the rates go down for syphilis. They plummet kind of at the end of the book. We also have in there, there's something called the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, where they were leaving poor black men in Alabama untreated for syphilis, even though they knew the consequences. There was a thought that maybe black people and white people experience syphilis differently. So at the end of this book in the 60s, there's already some people saying, hey, this experiment's not cool. We need to stop it. So it's a interesting time period to bookend syphilis.
And it would be interesting during the, if there's a Q&A, which I think there will be after the reading with Jamie Ford, it'd be interesting to ask him, you know, about that, you know, because you know he did quite a bit of research in the creation of the architecture of this book and the arc of the characters' lives and the time period. And that would be fascinating to know, you know, how he put that together too.
Yeah.
So another aspect of, a cultural aspect of this novel that I think is so important is just the world, the window that we get into not only the ladies' houses, you know, but this sort of hierarchy. This hierarchy for, you know, sex workers during that time period and the stigmas even that they had and the prejudice they had towards one another. And so I was wondering, Crystal, if you could sort of talk about, you know, our own colorful history a little bit, and if any of that similar sort of tension existed, and then if you, you know, sort of what you made of that difference, you know, Mama.
Yeah, definitely. Just to give you a little bit of background on our red light district here in Bozeman, so you have some context to better understand what I'm going to be talking about. We had a red light district. Probably we had prostitutes working in Bozeman right after it was founded in 1864. That where people are, there is prostitution. So probably came not long after the town's founding. But we don't have a lot of documents from that time. We don't have a lot of evidence of prostitution here in Bozeman until about the 1870s, 1880s. So that's when Bozeman was incorporated as a town in 1883. So it was a town from 1864, but incorporated as a city in 1883. So that's when we start getting a lot of documentation. We get arrest records, we have death certificates, death index, those sorts of things. And those are the places that we find mention of these ladies, are in all those little different areas. So we have to glean all this information from all these different ledgers and documents and newspapers and city directories and all those things and put them together into this story. And so we start seeing more of that in the 1870s, but the 1880s is really when this district kind of, I think, really got up and going as a district. So the district itself was over on Mendenhall Street between Rouse and Bozeman. And so if you can kind of visualize that in your head, the tap room is on one corner of that now, or Montana Provisions is on the south side. I'm seeing some heads nodding. That's good. And then it went for that whole block down to Bozeman. It also incorporated the alley between Main Street and Mendenhall Street. So that was sometimes referred to as China Alley. And so that was part of the district as well. And so, the district was only mainly on the south side of Mendenhall Street, not on the north side, but more on the south side. So it's just that restricted little block. And that's how it was throughout the nation during this time. Red light districts were just that. They were restricted districts, and they were, the houses of ill repute were kept right in a small area. And that's, I visualize how it was here in this book as well. And they did that purposefully because they wanted the ladies of the evening all to be in one place. They didn't want a house of ill repute popping up in a nice neighborhood. So, so they kept everybody together. And of course, the Chinese were often part of that red light district. You see again and again where there's a red light district that incorporates the Chinese as well. And the Chinese live there. They have laundries. Their laundries are located there. The curio shops are located there. Chinese restaurants are located there. But they were allowed to kind of go out of the district and have shops on Main Street and other places. But the ladies were not. They were kept to that district, and they were pretty much confined to that area. In fact, as in Jamie's book as well, it really talks about how they are sequestered in those houses, and they're not really allowed to go and mix with the community. And that's how I feel like it was here in Bozeman as well. They were really kept to that restricted district. So our district was kind of thriving during the time of Jamie's book as well. I mean, this place was, the red light district was just booming in kind of 1904, 1905, all the way to 1915-ish. Things were really going strong. But by 1918, it was gone. It was done. It was closed up. They kept trying to close it. They started to try to close it down in about 1910. I think it had the opposite effect, and it actually bolstered the district. But by 1918, they had wiped it completely out. So that's a little bit of background on the district. When I was reading this book, of course, I was thinking about Madame Flora's in the book. And I was thinking, do we have a Madame Flora here in Bozeman? And, you know, we do. We did. her name was Lizzie Woods. And Lizzie, I think about Lizzie Woods, and I think about her being very similar to Madame Flora. And her house was probably not as grand as Madame Flora's house, but it was probably one of the grandest houses in Bozeman. And it was located right on the corner of Mendenhall and Rouse. So if you can think of that corner, it has the Montana Provisions, new restaurant, kind of restaurant meat shop on the corner there. Her house sat just right kind of in that general area, right behind the Bozeman Hotel. So that's where her house was. And it was a two-story brick veneered built house. She had a very nice manicured lawn. There was a beautiful fence around it with a wooden sidewalk. And so that was kind of the high-class house here in town. It had a parlor. It had four rooms upstairs. And it had, I think, one or two bedrooms downstairs. So there was a lot happening in that house that probably was very similar to Madame Flora's house. But at the height of the district, we had about 8 houses of ill repute here in Bozeman. So Lizzie's was just one of them. So there was a lot of ladies working. And if you can imagine 8 houses with 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 ladies in each of them, there's a lot going on there. So that was a similar thing. I want to speak to that. You know, Lizzie Woods was that madam, but there was that hierarchy. And that was present here in Bozeman as well. So you had a madam like Lizzie Woods, who was a very savvy businesswoman. She made a lot of money. She did really well. And she worked in the district from 1886 all the way to her death in 1918. So she worked in this business in this town for 32 years, which is amazing. And there was a lot of highs and lows during that time for her. But she had a good head for business, and she made a lot of money, and she did well. But then there was the working girls, who probably didn't make as much money. Maybe some of them did, maybe some of them did not. There was also, just like in this book, there was the Chinese and the Japanese who were working in Bozeman as well. And of course, because it's harder to find some of those people, we don't have as many names of those women. I've been able to find just a few names of the Chinese women and one Japanese woman I've come across. So we did have those women here as well, and they were probably enslaved. They were probably working as slaves in China Alley right here in Bozeman. So there was that huge dichotomy of these women all in this one block area. Some were making a lot of money. Some were working in slavery. It was a very complex situation with a lot of violence, but also a lot of some of the women really took care of each other as well. So it's not a black and white situation there.
Do you have any hit records in Bozeman? Now, my own little personal curiosity is with Lizzie Wood. Do you have any? Madame Flora had deep connections in the city and connections with powerful political figures, and she wielded that leverage. Many of the clients were very prominent members of the community, things like that. Have you been able to find any historical evidence that indicates that she, too, here in Bozeman, mm-hmm. had a similar role?
You know, not as much with Lizzie. She did have really strong connections to community members, a lot of men community members, but a really good example is with another house of ill repute. The one that's still standing is 234 Mendenhall Street. It's the white stucco with the green shutters. And that was a house that was built by Joseph Lindley. So we all know Lindley from Lindley Park, and he was a prominent businessman here in Bozeman. And he was really involved with the ladies. He was the administrator on most of their wills. He was, his name just pops up all the time in the red light district. In fact, there's this article in the newspaper. He built a house specifically for prostitution, or so it was claimed in the newspaper. But the people were up in arms because Joseph Lindley was building this house in the red light district, and they knew he was building it just for the purpose of prostitution, and they were not happy about that. And of course, Joseph Lindley completely denied that, but, you know, I think he totally did build that house just for prostitution. So Nelson Story was a part of that house as well. He owned it at one point. He sold it to his son, Nelson Story Jr. So there's also been connections with Nelson Story and some of the other ladies. So yeah, so there's definitely strong ties.
Well, let's bring sort of a lot of the topics in this novel, which I mean these two topics are really tied together. Sort of, you know, the culture of the hierarchy and both the interactions of the different, you know, different houses of ill repute, as you like to say, or they were called crib houses. Remember how they had a very derogatory term for some of the other houses in Seattle during this time period? But let's move back to this whole topic, which is sort of our topic for the evening, which is sort of then tied to syphilis, which is something that Madame Flora, you know, succumbs to in a pretty... We were given the impression in the novel that it is progressing for a long time, but then suddenly becomes apparent, and it's something they can't hide, and it's something that is visible. And so let's move into the present, and let's talk a little bit. I have a question for you, Cindy, and that has to do sort of like, how can you talk to the role of syphilis, you know, in the present day, you know, because it seems like when I introduced this and I said, you know, we're talking about public health and we're talking about public health awareness, I think this is where we sort of move into the modern day, and we talk about the importance of being informed and understanding this disease. Yeah.
So in Montana, our rates of syphilis have been pretty low for the last 20 years. In 2016, we started to see an increase in rates, and that was along with all STIs, so not just syphilis. And when we say an increase, it's also, I don't want to freak you out, but it went from like the average of 9 or 10 cases a year to average of 40 cases a year. So if you look at that percentage-wise, that's a big increase, but real number, that's not a huge increase. The state was pretty progressive and so started implementing rapid syphilis testing. It's just a quick finger stick, and then you can go on for further testing if that test is reactive. Syphilis testing is mandatory or should be done with every pregnancy because of the ill effects of congenital syphilis. It can lead to a lot of complications. And it's very easily treatable in the first or second stage with just a dose of penicillin. So the more we can talk about it and get people access to testing and treatment, the better off we can be.
Do you think that there's also today, though, still sort of a reluctance on the part of some people to get tested? I mean, what are some of, you say that we were talking before the panel tonight about what might be some of the contributing factors to this increase, and the increase is nationwide too, isn't it? And what are some of those, I know the variables are kind of murky, but what are some of the ideas that they have about that?
Some of the ideas out there, we were talking, people like to blame the dating apps, that it's easier to have anonymous sex, but we could see that that's been going on for hundreds of years. So that seems like too easy of an answer for me. It also could be that there was a real concern after HIV where people were using condoms, and now we're kind of, you know, decades after the scare and there's less concern and less condom use. It could also be once we have more of something, the easier it is to encounter it. It could also be increased testing, so people are concerned, and it could just be this increase is just that we're doing a better job of catching cases. So it's probably a combination of a bunch of those and probably some things I haven't even thought of.
You mentioned earlier, you said, at least in the book and when we talk about Flora, it's hers is a neurosyphilis. And then you said that's maybe one of the more interesting, you know, sort of manifestations. But what are the different sort of types of this?
Yeah, so do you guys just want a primer, like a quick, okay, on syphilis? Okay, so syphilis is interesting. It's called the great imitator, and it could look like a lot of different things. The first stage when you get it is a painless ulcer. That's how tricky it is, because when you look at the picture, it looks like it should hurt. It's this red eroded area, and it's transmitted through sexual intercourse. So it can be hiding anywhere in the vagina, in the rectum, in the mouth, underneath the foreskin. And since it doesn't hurt, most people don't know they have it. It's very rare we actually get cases from that primary stage. Then if that's untreated, it goes away. And a couple weeks later, you get a rash all over your body, or it could just be on your hands, or it could just be on your feet. It could be so light that you don't even see it. It doesn't itch, so you would never be bothered by it. And then if that's untreated, it just kind of goes away as well. And then 10, 20, 30 years later is when you start to see the other effects. And it can sit in your brain, and that's when you have neurosyphilis. It can also sit in your heart, though, and you can have some cardiac issues. It can sit in your joints and your bones, so you can have joint issues. It can sit in your connective tissue, so you get almost like you and your dogs get lipomas, those things. So you can get, they're called gummas, all over your body. So there's interesting pictures of artists with these gummas all over their face. And so those are the different stages. You can treat syphilis in the primary and secondary stage very easily. Once it's gone on to the neurosyphilis or to the other stages, if you treat someone, they won't have further complications, but it doesn't erase all the damage that's been done. So earlier the better.
And we definitely see that in, you know, at the time. Are we led to believe, as far as you have your understanding, that there, because you said that there wasn't that first initial test, actually, in the earlier part of the novel, that there, and that it, maybe that's what you're thinking is intentional. Like, there's no cure for Madame Flora. There's no alternative route. And so hers is sort of seen as a one-way progression, which makes the novel certainly poignant. It makes her maybe a more sympathetic character than she might be at other times. But it really does sort of highlight sort of the tragic outcome.
Yeah. Well, and even her trip where did she go? Germany for this new treatment. I was wondering if that was a reference to the Salverson treatment too, that she was going there for this last hope. I read somewhere where they were thinking 10 to 20% of the population was infected at one time or another. And I don't know specific sex workers. Do you have that?
I don't know specific to sex workers. I know that some of the numbers that have been bandied about for U.S. Soldiers during World War I was that it was about a 10% infection rate. But once again, you know, those numbers aren't exactly statistically accurate according to our standards, but they do give us some sense for what was prevalent at the time. Interestingly enough, I would love to ask both of you a question. I won't derail the discussion, but the research I've done is, as we look at, you know, it shows up in about 1918, where the Montana Health Department refers to prostitutes as a suspect case, meaning they can be quarantined, isolated, tested without signs, symptoms, or consent because they were seen as being, like, so, you know, such prevalent character, or, you know, as a demographic. Does that sort of make sense with what you folks both have come in contact with, or do you feel as if that's more sort of a class-based judgment?
I think that was a national, that was happening nationally as well. Yeah. And in Montana. But I think that they were really worried about the troops or the recruits for World War I. And so they put a lockdown on all prostitution, all red light districts, and really, incarcerated a lot of women, in that, who were suspected of having venereal disease of some kind. So, yeah, definitely.
I think about the syphilis cases in women kind of like Typhoid Mary as well. So we knew Typhoid Mary wasn't the only person who had typhoid at the time, but she's the person we know. She was poor. She was Irish, which was an undesirable group at that time. She sounded like she was a bit of a spitfire and got mad at people and told them about themselves. So, and then she gets sent off to an island to finish off her life. So I wonder if there's some of those characteristics.
It is interesting just to think about, you know, this sort of, we are holding these women to this, you know, because of their employment, because of their profession, we can identify them. But then we forget that they had lots of clients. And so they're sort of seen, you know, we look into culpability here, right? And you know, it's interesting that historically, you know, they are seen as the culpable ones, you know, and I love how there's all this legislation, well, because we can identify them, and that, you know, I just think that's an interesting irony that goes along with that. Do any of you have, I mean, I have some other questions, but you are there some particular aspect of this novel that's tied to your interest area and your expertise that you really wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on? I want to make sure that we don't neglect that. If you had something where you were thinking, oh, I can't wait to talk about that. I think that's important that it came from you. So is there one particular idea? I saw you through your notes there.
I know. So when Jan talked to me about this this panel, I was so excited to do this research because I hadn't ever got to it, and I wanted to do this research. So I did it to talk about tonight, and it was really interesting. I was wondering how many women died of syphilis here in Bozeman, or died of effects that could have been like Madame Flora's or something related to syphilis, I guess. And so I took that, there's a ledger of death records. So every person who died in Bozeman from 1885 to 1922 is written down in this ledger. And this ledger is at the Clerk and County Recorder's Office, so if you want to go check it out, you can. But it's a big, huge ledger. And so I went through that whole ledger to see how many prostitutes died in Bozeman, first of all. And so in that amount of time, only 9 prostitutes died. So so I looked for any woman who had who had an occupation listed as prostitute. And then there was a few that I knew were prostitutes who weren't listed as prostitutes, so I added them into the mix. Surprisingly, Lizzie Woods was not listed as a prostitute or a madam. She was listed as something else, I can't remember, a lodging house owner. So I thought that was really interesting, but I knew she was, so I put her in the mix. But there was 9, and so only 1 of the 9 actually died of chronic syphilis. So on her death certificate, it says chronic syphilis as the cause of death. And her name was Ada Stella Wilson. And she has a really interesting story that I'll tell really quickly. She was a woman who was born back east somewhere, not really sure where. And she was part of the orphan train. So if you guys have heard of the orphan train, there was a lot of children in orphanages in New York and a lot of places on the East Coast. They put them on a train and sent them west. And so she was one of those orphans, and she was picked up by a family in Nebraska, and she was 3 years old when this happened. So all she had are the clothes on her back, and the family took her in and they raised her as part of their family. And so she lived with them until she was about 19 or 20 years old, and then she just disappeared. And we find out later she came west and she worked in Butte in Pleasant Alley. So you can imagine what happened in Pleasant Alley in Butte. But she worked as a prostitute in Butte and then made her way to Bozeman in 1908 and started reconnecting with her family in Nebraska. She started writing her mother letters in Nebraska. And so, but she was sick. She might have known she was sick when she started writing to her mother in Nebraska. She started sending her mother money. And then she died in 1910 of chronic syphilis. So one of the ladies that worked with her sent her mother a note and said, I just want to let you know that your daughter died. And so the mother back in Nebraska was experiencing some financial hardships. So she knew that, she knew what Ada Stella did. She knew she was a prostitute. And so she started asking the administrator of the will for the money that Ada had. And unfortunately, the family, they had never formally, legally adopted Ada. And so the administrator asked for that legal adoption records, and she said, well, we didn't formally do it. We just raised her. And because of that, the mother wasn't able to get Ada's money. It was only about $256, but it went back to the city and into the city coffers instead of going to her mother. But so that's the only story of, that's the only of those nine women who died of syphilis. Just to give you, and this kind of gives you a sense of the, of these ladies' lives and the district. I'm just going to read what the others died of, and this will give you a sense of their lives. Jessie Smith, 20 years old, note that how old these women are, died of suicide, overdose of morphine. Lillian Stewart died at 22 years old of an overdose of morphine accidental. So, Hattie Hayes died at 29 years old of cancer, necrosis of the sacrum. She'd actually died of sepsis, but necrosis of the sacrum. So that's, you know, your back was, it was kind of degrading. And so I talked to a gynecologist about this, and she had no idea what this meant. So I don't know, maybe some of you might have any ideas, but I don't know what was happening with her. Gertrude Jenkins died at 23 years old of a infection in the bloodstream after childbirth. And she probably developed clots in her brain or lungs because she actually died of an embolism. So, and then Ada, we've got Ada, chronic syphilis. And then another woman by the name of Faye Wilson died at 23 years old. After a surgery for an infection of her fallopian tubes. And this probably could have been because of an STD. And then we have Jenny Bolos, who died at 40 years old, and she died of alcoholism. Libby Hayes, the sister of Hattie, who I mentioned earlier, Libby Hayes died at 34 years old of cancer of the uterus. She actually died of sepsis from that. And then the last one, Lizzie Woods. Lizzie outlived all of them. She lived until she was 65 years old, and she died of nephritis, which is inflammation or infection of the kidneys, probably from living a pretty hard life. So kind of gives you a sense, and it's not a pleasant sense of how these women lived and died.
And I think that's important to remember, because in some ways, Madame Flora's house is so glamorized, you know, and the lives of these women is really glamorized, and that it sometimes forget, as opposed to the way that the crib houses are depicted, we kind of forget that they were just as subject to these conditions and just as, you know, as any of the other, you know, sex workers at that time. So it kind of does cast an interesting light, an alternative light to the world that Jamie Ford paints in Madame Flora's house, you know? Okay. Do any of the rest of you have something you really...
You know, as you were reading these, it struck me that we're not so much more advanced and civilized than this time period. I mean, just today we got an alert that there's something like 9 or 12 deaths that are attributable to fentanyl overdoses. So you see that with the overdoses. I mean, uterus cancer, I think of HPV. I mean, it's pretty similar. That's really striking when you were reading that to me, or reading it out.
I mean, it's funny what those records will yield when you look into them, isn't it? Yeah. Which then makes us think of more questions for Jamie Ford when they talk about it. So I guess as we come, you know, bring it to a close and sort of think about some just general questions, I would think that it sounds like all three of you are particularly drawn to historical fiction or like historical fiction, maybe not exclusively, but if you are, what is it about historical fiction? I know as a high school teacher, many of my students, that's some of the biggest draw for them, something that's grounded in reality, grounded in a real event, you know? They really connect with that. And if you do, what do you think it is about that genre that makes it so compelling?
I think that there is a real attraction to something that was real. And historical fiction makes that claim. It really happened. And it sort of fills in the parts that we can't know for sure, to sort of create a complete story. But it does make the claim to veracity, that this was a real human experience that actually occurred. I was just talking earlier with Jan about historical objects and how my students get so excited about seeing the real old thing, not just a copy of it, not just a scan of it, but the real thing. And there is that sort of excitement about something tangible, that this is verifiable, that it has substance. And historical fiction does that for us. It has that sense of legitimacy, that this isn't completely made up, that it could have really happened, even if we can't verify every single thing about it. And that has a tremendous draw because we love stories, you know, humans, we...
And I think sometimes for some people who are skeptical about other genres, it legitimizes the fiction too, because it's grounded in something real and something that they can go look at and something they can go research and find out more about. I find that at least some of my students. Yeah. Do either of you have an idea of that?
We're fascinated with history. You know, history is really compelling. And we as humans just love history. And I think there's times in your life where you like history more than at other times. You kind of come in and out of it. But I think we are drawn to historicity. We're drawn to our family history or global history. There's all these different aspects of history that different people are drawn to. But I think as humans, we just naturally veer towards history. And like I said at the beginning, historical fiction is a great way to access that and to better understand it. If you're not a historian and don't do that for a living, it's a great way to intersect with it.
I would agree. And I think that, you know, part of, at least at the high school, we have our American Studies program, and that is such a great course that's offered at the junior level. And I think so much of the work that they read a lot of primary source, but also a lot of historical fiction that's embedded in those eras. And I think it just makes the history really rich. I think the students would agree. I think the teachers who teach the class would probably agree that that's the case. So I was just curious what you thought. And my last question really is, what are you reading? You know, we tend to make this assumption that people who are avid readers, oh, they must read a lot of novels. And people assume, I'm an English teacher, I must read a lot of novels. Well, actually, I read a lot of other stuff, too. And some of it's not quality material. I'm going to be very frank with you, you know. And I tell people literary potato chips and schlock is just fine at times. But I have a wide range of interests. So I'm curious, what are you currently reading?
I'm going back and forth between two books. One's called Midnight in Sicily. It's about the rise of the new mayor in Palermo, who's really cleaning up the mafia. And then the other is it's the latest edition of Inspector Montalbano, who's a Sicilian. I'm a little obsessed with Sicily right now. So it's like their version of Agatha Christie. But
well, I'm rereading the Widow Nash. If you haven't read it yet, you should. So this is a companion book. Is that how you, to this One Book, One Bozeman. And I read this maybe a year or two ago, and it's such a good novel. And Jamie Harrison lives in Livingston, and her father was Jim Harrison. And so it's an amazing novel. So I'm rereading it so I can, you know, speak intelligently about it when we and ask questions.
I'm on a totally different topic. I've been reading things about evolution and science lately. So my favorite book recently is The Evolution of Beauty, which is actually looking at beauty in animals, and specifically in birds. And it's a fabulous read. So I'd recommend it to anyone. It has nothing to do with syphilis.
Open it to the audience and see if anybody here has a question.
Well, I can give you what we hypothesize, because once again, we have very few formal records. So what we do know is that people did trial and error, and there are a lot of sort of natural remedies, certain plants actually that actually are growing in your garden, I would even hazard a guess, that reduce fertility. So some of these were very well known and were sometimes used that were, you know, sort of taken as herbal remedies. The other thing that people don't often talk about is that abortion is not really a very difficult technical procedure. The biggest challenge with it is cleanliness. And so we know in a lot of traditional cultures that people actually sometimes had the capability of inducing abortion, or sort of, I don't want to say surgically aborting, but could cause it to happen. And so when you had people who had these skills, one of their markets would be prostitutes, because there was a real market to be able to not be pregnant. And so some of this, the interesting thing is that this information would be transmitted orally. We don't have, I mean, I have yet to come, I would be thrilled to come across some sort of record of, you know, a healer at this time, or a worker at this time who wrote all of their, you know, recipes down. That stuff is so few and far between, because it would have been transmitted by explaining it to someone else at that time. So a lot of it was, frankly, dangerous things. So we know that, for example, women would use douching as a way of supposedly preventing conception, frequently with things that were horrific, like kerosene, things that would have been very, very painful. But we also know that some families had proprietary recipes that they swear worked, and they wouldn't share, you know, what was in them, but they altered the pH of the vagina enough that it made it unlikely that conception would happen. So we have to understand that, you know, there was also not very much knowledge, but then some pockets of knowledge, especially as we think about people being more in contact with agriculture. If you watch conception happen over and over and over again, you begin to figure out how to prevent it.
And, you know, a lot of women did have children. A lot of women who worked in the red light districts did have children. And so, you know, we see Lizzie Woods had a one-year-old child living with her in one of the census documents. So, and it said adopted baby. So so probably these children did grow up, you know, were born and did grow up in the house, or with family members, with outside family members, with family members in different places. There was another one of the ladies who worked here in Bozeman who had a child, and she, that child grew up in Minnesota with her family while she worked here in Bozeman. So there probably were children that were born, but there was probably also children who, you know, the one woman here died because of in childbirth. So they probably were having some children anyway.
Oh, yeah. Before the arsenic, that big advancement with the arsenic derivative, mercury was the treatment for syphilis. So the first big outbreak of syphilis was in 1490 something in Naples. And from the beginning, they always blamed other people. So the Italians said it was those French that came and invaded our city. And then the French brought it, and they're like, oh, it was the pesky Spaniards. And then they blamed it on the English. And it was always somebody else's disease that got brought over to them.